from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Stocks hit record highs again yesterday for investors after a big bull run-up. It's exciting, scary. Will they run on up? Will they swoon and fall? For baby boomers in or nearing retirement, it is a particularly fraught question. Many need a big boost to have a hope of a decent retirement, but the market can take as well as give. This hour, On Point: Boomers, the stock market, and the country's retirement crisis. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you saved for your retirement? How's that nest egg looking? Has it bounced back from the crash of 08? Is this any way to run the retirement economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. In a moment, we'll talk with Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller, who is skeptical about the market right now. But first, joining me from New Canaan, Connecticut, is Ashleya Ebling. She's associate editor at Forbes magazine, where she covers personal finance. Ashleya, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Markets at record highs. Are baby boomers in there in rich numbers?
Baby boomers are in the markets. They're in their 401ks. About 60% of 401k assets are in mutual funds and equities, so they need to be paying attention.
So does that, if they're in there, does that mean after last year's big performance and the bull market that's been out there, have boomers recovered from the losses of 2008, out of the Great Recession's beginning?
I looked at some numbers from Fidelity. They had the average 401k balance. They're one of the biggest 401k provider. At the market low, the average balance was $46,200, and they just put out first quarter 2014 numbers. It's up to $88,600. So there has been a recovery.
So if the market's up so high, how wide is that participation? That's people in 401ks. How much of the baby boom does that account for?
Well, that's the big problem. Only 46% of Americans are offered a workplace retirement plan, and that's why Congress has so many proposals right now to try to increase personal savings rates and try to come up with new plans and ways to save. Of those who are offered the plans, only 38% of workers actually made contributions to the plans last year. So just because you're offered one doesn't mean that you're putting money in, but you probably should be.
What's the backdrop here? Do we have a crisis on the retirement front? If that smaller percentage of people even have those plans, what about the rest of the population? Are they doing fine somehow just putting it in old-fashioned savings, or are they walking kind of naked toward retirement?
It's looking pretty bad. The statistics show that householders near retirement, those 55 to 64, have average account balances of only $12,000. By contrast, those with retirement accounts have balances of about $100,000. So clearly the retirement accounts are working for those who have them.
And what about now? With the market so high, boomers need those balances to stay strong if they're in retirement or headed there. It's kind of a white-knuckle time. You don't know whether to get in or get out, Ashleya. How are you advising people?
Well, we're sticking with the long-term approach. It's definitely important to stay in, but you have to look at your asset allocation based on your age and decide what's appropriate.
But where do you go if you're not in the market? A savings account, what, still is a teeny tiny returns. Bonds, people have been saying for a long time now, could plummet in value soon. Where do you advise people go?
It's the whole mix, the mix. And what one solution that's working for some people are target date funds. So you're not coming up with the mix, because a lot of this problem is with the individual retirement accounts. The onus is now on the individual to be an investment manager, and that's not what everyone's forte is. So what can happen is I did a post today on the increasing use of help in retirement accounts, so people using target date funds, and they're using managed accounts, and then they're having professionals actually manage their 401ks for them.
And with that, hoping that it all works out, but the market's high, some think it won't stay there, could come down just when a lot of people are headed into or are in retirement. Ashleya Ebling is with Forbes magazine, covers personal finance. Ashleya, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Here's the closing bell on the New York Stock Exchange yesterday. Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at another record high, 16,695. Now everybody's wondering where this goes. Here's Conway Gittens of Reuters reporting on yesterday's stock market record high closing numbers.
Another record high for blue chips, and the S&P 500 joined the party with its own record. The rally was broad-based, but investors were happy to grab beaten-down tech and biotech shares. As for the numbers, the Dow rallying 4 days in a row, the S&P 500 up roughly 1%, and the Nasdaq saw its best one-day gain in more than 2 months.
It's been a big bull run. Some people are wondering just how long it can go. Among them, Robert Shiller, winner of the 2013 Nobel Prize in Economics, professor of economics at Yale University. Robert Shiller, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
You're putting up warning signals. Why?
Well, the market is rather highly priced in the United States. I have a price-earnings ratio, which you can see on my website. I call it CAPE, cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, and it's at 25 now. It was higher in 2000, but the market crashed after that, as you may remember. It was higher in 1929, and it was higher one other time, and that's 1901, after which the market did horribly also. So it's looking a little bit worrisome, more than a little bit, I'm still in the market. I'm wondering.
your price earnings ratio looks at a 10-year horizon rather than a typical 1 year. Does it look better on the standard P.E. ratio, or is yours scarier, Robert Shiller?
Yeah, well, mine takes an average of earnings over 10 years for the denominator. And the earnings, well, they've been kind of jumping around, but they're doing reasonably well right now, and so they're doing quite well right now. If you take an average, it would be lower, so that makes the price-earnings ratio higher. So I believe that, you know, people look, they tend to look at price divided by 12-month earnings, but earnings are so sensitive to business conditions that that can be very misleading. That's why I prefer to use this CAPE ratio.
A lot of people trying to figure out what to do here. They need a return somewhere to try and bolster retirement savings. But the market's already gone up a lot. Bull runs don't last forever. You're saying that only three or four times in this century that it's been the price earnings ratio, by your calculation, has been higher than now. And it's been that high in the past on the eve of big tumbles. If that's the case, why are you and so many others still in the market?
Well, because the market isn't the unified whole, I'm in low-priced sectors of the market. It's not all high. I think one important lesson that is not new at all, it's the lesson of value investing. So there are value funds that will put you into relatively lower priced stocks. I have my own value fund that I've been offering. I won't try to sell that here. There's lots of them out there, and you'll do, I think, somewhat better in those. On the other hand, as you were just pointing out, the alternatives to stocks are not so great either, and you have to put your money somewhere. So that's why I think some value portfolio in the stock market is still a sensible thing to do.
Of course, not everybody in the market is in value funds. Not everybody is untutored in this. Some very high-priced stocks are still right up there. How do you interpret that? Is it because of Fed policy, because interest rates are so low? Is it because stock markets around the world have been doing fairly well in the last little bit here? How do you interpret it?
Well, it's kind of, I think of it as investor psychology with some Fed input. We're coming out of the worst crisis, financial crisis, since the Great Depression. Stocks were really beaten down in 2009. Now they're coming back. Now, so yeah, you're asking what's on investors' minds. Well, one of the things is that interest rates are so low, and that's what the Fed did to try to stimulate the economy. So people are they call it reaching for yield. They just don't feel good about earning so little on interest. You know, short rates are just about zero. And so they go into this. You could look at long-term bonds, but as you were saying, they could drop in price, so they're risky. So I think it's not surprising. And there's also a little bit of the herd mentality that when the market is going up, maybe more than a little bit, people start thinking, I want in on this too, just because it's going up.
Your numbers say pretty loud and clear, it could also go down here and go down pretty strongly. The examples you cite of previous times when your P.E. ratio was at such a high led to some pretty dramatic falloffs.
Right. In 2007, just before this crisis, my ratio, CAPE ratio, was 24. So we're just a little bit above that now. After that, you know, the stock market in real terms fell almost in half in a space of 2 years.
That would be pretty disastrous for boomers right now. This can be a tough market for the little guy to navigate. Is it tough for big investors as well, Robert Shiller?
It certainly is. Nobody knows the future. It's people that determine the market, and people are very complicated. You know, it's not like weather forecasting. The weather is different. It's physics. It's fluid dynamics. It's that sort of thing. There's mathematical models of that. Well, economists try to build mathematical models, but they don't forecast that well. It's just because it's people, not winds.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about new stock market highs, talk of a bubble, and the challenge for Americans trying to save for retirement, the country's really retirement savings crisis this hour. Robert Shiller is with us, Nobel Prize-winning economist, professor of economics at Yale University. Of course, it's happened before, and just that way. Jeanine Cook moved to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, to live out her retirement. But in the year after the 2008 stock market crash, her retirement fund plummeted by half. She described the loss in an interview with PBS's Now.
What we have lost in the stock market is devastating to us because that's our retirement. That's our money. You know, you put it away for the rainy day. It's pouring out.
That was then. This is now. If you stayed in, a lot has come back. But now we're high again, just as people are staring at retirement. Robert Shiller is with us in New Haven, Connecticut. With us as well right now from Lubbock, Texas, is Michael Finke. He's professor and director of the Center for Retirement Planning and Living at Texas Tech University. He's done extensive research into how Americans save for retirement. Michael Finke, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be here, Tom.
Robert Shiller says, watch out for this market. Handle with great care. It's at exciting highs, but we all know what that can mean. And at the same time, we've got this huge cohort marching toward retirement. What's the recipe we're looking at for Michael?
Yeah, I think we have to have a realistic expectation of what kind of returns we're going to be getting on stocks and bonds in the future. We have the largest cohort in the history of mankind now approaching retirement. All of them are bidding for stocks and bonds at the same time, and it's not just that. We have a global economy where there are a lot of countries that have higher savings rates than the United States, and they're all bidding on stocks and bonds as well. And what we have now is an unprecedented situation where stocks are very expensive, and bonds are also providing very low yields. So asset returns are probably going to be lower in the future, and that means we need to change some of our ideas about how well we're going to live in retirement and when we should retire.
A lot of people looking at retirement are going to look at those stock market returns from last year when they were such a banner year, 30% plus. I mean, that looks pretty amazing. And you know how these waves of investment go. A lot of small-time investors can come in just when they see those big numbers because they look irresistible, Michael.
Yeah. Our research shows that we tend to be courageous at the wrong times, and we also tend to be very fearful at the wrong times. The 3 months with the biggest net outflows from stock mutual funds were January, February, and March of 2009. And investors did particularly poorly if they pulled money out of the market at that time. A lot of investors think that now is a good time to invest in the stock market because prices have gone back up. But generally, if things are more expensive, that means that the rate of return that we can expect in the future is probably going to be lower.
So what does it mean for investors, baby boomers who maybe haven't ridden these wonderful resurgent waves of the stock market? So haven't, you know, as you say, they got out at the wrong time, in at the wrong time. How are they positioned for retirement?
Well, I think that it means that they need to save more. And I think that it also means that they need to think about retiring a little bit later. Most boomers that I've talked to who have reached their early 60s are feeling like they're not quite ready to retire. And I think probably the best strategy is, and by the way, it's important to note that we've gained about 6 years in longevity since 1950 in the United States. So that means we have to fund a that's about 6 years longer than our parents or grandparents may have had to fund with their savings. And it's okay to retire a little bit later. I think a lot of people see age 62 as being a normal retirement age because that's when you're first eligible for Social Security. But you can wait until you're 70 to get your Social Security, and it might be worth waiting a few more years till you have enough money saved up for a comfortable retirement.
Of course, a lot of people don't have that money saved up and don't have good employment prospects for the period of time you're talking about, Michael.
Well, that's a bad situation. But I think that means that you may have to reduce your expectations of how well you can live on in retirement. A lot of people, over a third, rely primarily on Social Security.
Which means pretty mean circumstances. Robert Shaler, do we have the right institutional, structural envelope for most Americans here approaching retirement? If we've got so many, we heard from at the top of the hour, way down there, you know, looking at maybe $12,000 saved, if that, or relying purely on Social Security?
We don't have the optimal structure. So one thing, the 401k plan or 403b, these are the contribution plans where you contribute your own money on a tax-deferred basis. Those weren't really the invention of some social planner. Those were started around in the early 1980s as a tax dodge. And the problem, the big problem with them is that many people don't contribute. Or, you know, they kind of postpone it. They're too busy. We have too many bills now, and they never get around to it. Or if they do contribute, they don't contribute enough. Or they think that the problem is solved if they do the maximum, and they should do even more saving. So we do have a system that was never really thoughtfully planned and calculated. Now, we do fortunately have Social Security, and that is the big savior for so many people. But even that is not optimal. And it could be improved.
And that can be a pretty lean living if that's what you end up depending on. Let's go to our listeners, Frank in Onalaska, Wisconsin. Frank, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Great show. I'd like the discussion to address a recent Nobel Prize-winning study, which I believe was out of the University of Chicago, that basically said the small-time investors shouldn't be in the stock market. Their information is too slow. Their actions are always advised to not get out of the market when it's starting to decline, but I never hear any discussion about this particular study. My own experience, I'm invested in the state of Wisconsin pension system, which is one of the few across the country that's performed well, but I've also seen my other non-state-funded investments tank several times. So my question there is, particularly here at its peak, how does a small-time investor know when to change their asset allocation when it hasn't tanked? Usually you don't get the information in a timely manner, and you know, you run the risk of losing everything because our holdings are a lot smaller than the big Wall Street investment companies.
Absolutely. Frank, we'll pick it up, and I appreciate your call. Michael Finkel, what about in an individual's case? There's Frank calling with that question. And what about more broadly? Are we setting Americans up for success or failure here?
Well, I think that we've done a good job since the Pension Protection Act of providing additional alternatives like target date funds that people can invest in without having to think too much about their asset allocation. I think that these types of automatic investments are really well suited to people who don't have a whole lot of investment experience. I'll also make the point that we shouldn't be afraid of investing in stocks. There are very few historical periods where if you had been a long-run investor, you would have done worse if you'd invested in stocks. In fact, you can make the argument that people in general should probably have more of their portfolio invested in stocks on average. And these types of products are a way to allow people to invest in stocks without having to manage their own assets very actively.
But here I'm looking at a Wall Street Journal hypothetical. Suppose you retired in October 07. You had a $500,000 nest egg, which, you know, according to the averages, that's very good in this country right now. If you had split that 60% into the S&P and 40% in an aggregate bond index, and you were taking out just 4% a year, the old formula, you know, $20,000 in portfolio income. By the end of February 2009, your nest egg would have shrunk to less than $320,000. That's pretty shocking for most people, Michael.
Yeah, and I think that it's important to remember that the returns that you get on your portfolio over the first 10 years of retirement can have a big impact on how sustainable your retirement portfolio is over time. So it does make some sense potentially to have less risk in your portfolio once you retire, at least at the very beginning.
So Robert Shaler, you're our Nobel Prize winning economist. Look out for 10 years from now. If people are approaching it right now, what do you see coming in terms of historical return trends?
Well, as I said, the market is high, quite high. So I think they're reduced from historical averages. The historical average return, as documented by a number of people, for the last 200 years has been, in real inflation-corrected terms, something like 6-7%, depending on sample period. I don't think we can expect to do that well. But on the other hand, I don't think that it's negative. The market will jump around, but I'm thinking that it will yield probably some positive return over the next 30 years. You want to hold a diversified portfolio with some stocks in it, some bonds, even some real estate, just to diversify around the world. What I think people really need is investment advisors. In my book, Subprime Solution, I pushed that hard, but got very little response. That I think the government should help subsidize more than they do now investment advice. People shouldn't be on their own negotiating this.
But who's going to sit down with somebody who has $12,000 or $20,000 in their savings and spend time on advice? You know, everyone's right. Looking for some profit in it.
Well, there are people who will do that on an hourly basis. You can go to National Association of Personal Financial Advisors website, NAPFA. Unfortunately, I understand that they charge between $75 an hour to $300 an hour. And so, well, they're expensive. That's because they're financial experts, and those people have other alternatives. That's why I think it should be subsidized. But even if it's not subsidized, I think people of relatively modest incomes would do well to get an hour's time or a couple hours' time from someone like that, because you can learn a lot fast about the mistakes you're making.
Michael Finke, Robert Shiller's got the Nobel Prize, and he's foreseeing below-average returns for some years now, just as this cohort is headed in. You say those first 10 years really matter. If we've got a retirement crisis, how is it exacerbated if we're facing a period, maybe a decade, of lower-than-average returns?
Well, it's really a math problem. It is, we have a certain number of years that we live in retirement, and we can expect a certain return on our assets. If your asset return is going to be lower, it simply means that you need to save more, or you need to spend less, or you need to retire later. And I think being realistic about these types of choices is the best thing that you can do right now as an individual. Take some control over your retirement planning. Think about what you're going to be doing in retirement and how much money you're going to need, and then save that amount of money so that you're sure to live the lifestyle that you want.
That sounds like a big idea right now, to be sure of living that. Patrick in Worcester, Massachusetts. Patrick, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Call, Tom.
Yeah.
I'm going to represent the middle class and the tradesmen and people out there trying to make a living and looking forward to retiring when we're 75 and 80 now, because we don't have the options of pensions and Social Security. Everybody's coming after our pensions and Social Security. They want more and more out of it. And we're not out here trained to be investors. This is all of our money is being taken by investors and financial advisors, quote unquote, and they're siphoning the money out of our pockets and putting it into their own pockets, and only because they're telling us that we have to be investor savvy people, and if not, it's our own fault and we're negligent. And you know, and good luck to you if you don't invest in the stock market, because that's the only thing that's left, right? And you know, it's okay for people that are making $250,000 or who have been raised in the investor class, who have been trained how to live like this and plan like this in the stock market and play the stock market because their dad was really good at it. But most of the people out there don't know what your guests are talking about. And when they talk, all we hear is a little bit of variation on a theme of, well, good luck, and it's all, you know, you got these options and this option, and if you invest for the long run and stay in the stock market, even if it goes down. The problem is, you know, we've had our values of our homes wiped out in the real estate crash, and the stock market crashes every 10 years, and we don't know when it's going to crash. The people that know when it's going to crash, they're the ones making out on this.
Patrick, we hear you loud and clear. It's sort of, hey, here's what you ought to do, and good luck to you. But it doesn't work out so well for a whole bunch of people. Certainly no confidence is not real high in it, we hear right there. Michael Fink, what about it structurally here? I mean, you hear the sort of the part of American society that our caller Patrick is speaking for, and he just doesn't feel like it's set up to work for him.
And I don't think he should have to be a pension manager. I don't think that it makes sense in the United States that we should have 300 million people who are responsible for making their own very complex investment and savings decisions. You know, we like to have freedom in the United States, and freedom in retirement accounts that means that we have a big variation in how much money people have saved and how well they're investing. Other countries take a slightly different path. Other countries make everyone save a certain percentage of their income for retirement, and they pay a lot more attention to the types of investments that they put that money into. And I think the Department of Labor has done a great job of trying to move us in a better direction. And as Professor Schiller said, this is not a system that was well planned out from the start. There are some tweaks that we can make in the current system, and I think it's very important for us to make sure that our politicians are making decisions that improve the system that we have and don't necessarily maintain the status quo, because there are a lot of people benefiting from the status quo, and there's a lot of improvements that can be made.
Is our caller Patrick wrong that there's a systemic problem right now with the expectations of what people are going to do, how they're going to invest? If you want tweaks like what to fix it?
Well, I think the first thing that we've done is we've introduced some incentives for people to invest in these qualified accounts into pre-diversified investments, so these target date type funds. The other things that we can do are make sure that everybody that's providing advice in those qualified accounts is a fiduciary, is legally required to look out for the best interest of the client. That's not the case now, and that's something that's actually being debated right now in Congress.
You mean they're advising you, but they don't have a legal commitment to look out for your best interests?
Yeah, I think that's something that's not necessarily well understood in the investment industry, that there is this there is not necessarily a requirement for those who are providing these accounts to make recommendations that are in the best interest of the client.
Robert Schiller, you can understand why the ordinary guy may be afraid to walk in for that advice you're talking about in that case.
Well, you know, we have to keep in mind that America is different. It's called American exceptionalism.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of the last countries in the world to set up Social Security among advanced countries because Americans don't want the government deciding their lives. So if that's what and America has done amazingly well.
Yes, it has.
Leaving much more to individual decisions. So the real difficulty here is where do we go? How much should the government be deciding? And you know, other countries would just have a pension plan, you know, and you're automatically in it. This goes back to the 1880s. Germany set up the first Social Security plan, but Americans didn't want that because they thought we're self-reliant. Okay, well, if that's what you want, you've got to be self-reliant or else vote in a different, more left-wing government.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about new stock market highs, talk of a bubble out there, and the challenge for Americans trying to save for retirement. Looking at the country's retirement savings, crisis, really not too strong a word, in the boomer cohort, very big and looking at retirement right now. Nobel Prize-winning economist 2013 Robert Shiller joins us today, professor of economics at Yale University, who's with us from New Haven, Connecticut. With us from Lubbock, Texas is Michael Finke, is professor and director of the Center for Retirement Planning and Living at Texas Tech University. Michael Finke, I'm told that you were at a conference recently where people are, Robert Shiller says Americans different, American exceptionalism, is, and it's done well for the country overall, no doubt. But here's this big batch of boomers headed toward retirement, and I think you've been hearing about maybe that kind of idea of expanding Social Security somehow to bring in a little more predictability about retirement income. Is that right?
This is something that's been discussed. Does it make sense for people with their 401k savings to be able to buy a little bit of a higher income from Social Security? And probably something that we haven't done a good enough a job addressing is how people turn their savings into an income at retirement. I think we may have done a better job in figuring out what people should be investing in before retirement, but figuring out how to pull the money out after retirement, that's something that we're going to need to address as the boomers make their way through the system.
Robert Shiller, what about the target date fund? You can have a money manager manage your funds in a big fund and aim it toward the year 2020 or 2030. Do we have enough of a track record with them to have expectations of how they would ride out a rough market period?
Well, they're relatively new. We don't have a long track record. One complaint about them is that they tend to have management fees that some people think are too high. But the basic idea of a target date fund is a sound one. The idea is that young people can afford the risk of risky investments like the stock market more, and that as they age, the portfolio should get less and less risky. That's a little bit of financial technology that each individual in the U.S. is left with on his or her own. So we can manage that better. And this is a example of a financial innovation. The only thing is, you better watch the management fees and not pay too much for it.
What's a reasonable management fee? What's an unreasonable fee?
Well, I don't have the range that's offered, but I would say under 1%. 1% a year adds up. In 10 years, that's 10% of your money. You want to keep it down, and you could consider doing something like that yourself, managing your own target model. But again, it takes attention, and realistically, people forget these things. Everyone is occupied with other concerns and is not ready to do the mathematical calculations.
Arthur in Middlebrook, Virginia. Arthur, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, I think the points that are being made are right on point. And I think that one thing that is, I personally had about $600,000 in the market in October 2007, told my financial advisor at Morgan Stanley, who was theoretically in a fiduciary relationship with me, I wanted out and put me someplace where I could get a 5% return reasonably safely. He said there's no such thing. All you could do is go into money markets at 1%, and convinced me that theoretically I was a reasonably intelligent investor.
Okay.
But and theoretically he had a fiduciary obligation to me. Basically, he was parking my money, getting 1%. And didn't want to be bothered with making the effort to find appropriate investments. My point being, even with a financial advisor, even with a fiduciary obligation, you have to watch exactly what's happening. You have to do your own exploration. And it's really at this point in time, the markets are so influenced by fractions of seconds, where there are computers buying and selling millions of shares, that it's really hard to figure out what your best option is.
Arthur, did you take a hit on that $600,000 nest egg?
About $350,000.
More than half gone?
Yes.
That hurts. Did you get back in the market? Did you recover that way, or were you afraid to?
The other side of that is I was convinced by my accountant that I should I was a smart guy. What do I need to pay an investment advisor for? Do it myself. And I discovered that I'm not that good at doing it myself. So I haven't recovered what I lost. I've been in the market, but not as substantially as I was before. And,
It's a tough story. I mean, it takes a long time to build a nest egg, and it can go in a hurry. Michael Finke, Arthur mentions this rapid trading. Michael Lewis is out there with his book about flash boys who are coming in and doing really fast trading, kind of working the system is the implication. And that's the kind of investment that ordinary folks just can't do. They don't have supercomputers at their fingertips. Is the market fair for the regular investor, Michael?
It has been. We do have a lot of evidence that individual investors underperform or institutional investors, but that's mainly because individual investors don't pay enough attention to fees, and they tend to move money in and out of the stock market at the right time. I don't think the right interpretation is that the deck is stacked against the individual investor. I think the right interpretation is that if we're not that experienced at managing our own money, then we need to select the right type of low-fee automatic investment, or we need to select an advisor that's going to be able to help us make the right choices.
You know, again, Robert Shiller was saying, this is America. We take personal responsibility, and we've done quite well with that. And you can see the evidence of that. At the same time, when we read about what a large percentage of the boomer cohort is not prepared for retirement, that can create a big social and economic problem in itself, can it, Michael?
Yeah, it's true. You know, we don't necessarily try to diagnose ourselves if we have a health problem. We see an expert. It makes sense, as Professor Shiller said, to see an expert when we have questions about financial planning in general. But we just need to make sure that the expert that we see is looking out for our best interest. And if we don't have the resources to hire an expert, you can make good choices in your 401k plan by paying attention to fees and choosing well-diversified investments.
David in Hyannis, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. You just mentioned that, well, we're Americans and we have a culture of personal responsibility. I think that's more of an ethos than a reality. Earlier, you spoke of the fact that when boomers finally enter retirement, or as boomers enter retirement, we'll see what the consequences are. I fear that what the consequences are going to be is that boomers are going to realize they haven't saved enough, they haven't taken responsibility for their own retirement, and that their children and their children's children are going to be left holding the bag.
Does that mean you, David, holding the bag?
I'm not so much worried about my generation. I'm worried about my children. I'm the child of a boomer, and what I see, crumbling infrastructure, a failure to provide for early childhood intervention, poor public schools, and yet the boomers will always vote themselves a big prescription drug benefit at the expense of their children's children.
David, I appreciate your call. Robert Shiller, what about the intergenerational implications if we've got a lot of many millions who aren't well prepared to cover their own retirement?
Well, yeah, this is the fundamental thing. We need what's called intergenerational risk sharing. And ultimately, I think we have to realize that we are a country and that we care about each other within the country. That was the whole idea of Social Security, where we will take care of our elderly. And so if Social Security fails, what will we do? Well, I would have to say we'll raise taxes on the working people. I'm hopeful that that's the way this country works. We're not going to let our elderly people starve.
But our caller is younger. He's looking at the breadth of that potential burden. And if I recall correctly, when Social Security began, there were a dozen people working for each retiree. Now it's coming down to like 3 or 2 to 1. That's a bigger burden, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But on the other hand, GDP, gross domestic product, has been growing per capita something like 2% a year. I know it looks a little iffy after the financial crisis, but even so, it's been growing. And so, it isn't as bad as the doomsayers say. You have to take care of your parents. We'll collectively have to take care of our elderly parents. And health care is improving. They're going to have big medical bills. It's a problem, but I think it's not insurmountable. And as long as this country keeps moving ahead, it'll be okay.
Michael Fink, we love it. Michael Fink, what do you say to the concern from our younger caller about, you know, crumbling infrastructure and all the social or spending priorities he'd like to see pursued that he fears won't be taken care of because here you've got the boomers looking at their retirement years and not prepared to cover them?
Well, I think it's a legitimate fear. I was just at a conference where they had a slide that showed changes in spending by age group since 1980, so between 1980 and 2010. And what it showed is that older age groups have increased their spending during that time period and that younger people are actually spending about the same amount in 2010 that they did in 1980. And we do have a lot of transfer programs that tend to favor older groups. So in addition to worrying about the boomers, we also need to worry about investing in the younger generation because they're going to be the ones funding Social Security in the future.
Can we cover it all? If we can't, what happens?
Well, I think we're going to need to be a little bit more modest about our expectations of spending growth, how much we can spend in retirement, and even how much we can spend during our working years, because that's going to mean that we're going to have to save more. I mean, it's not low asset returns aren't just affecting the older generation. They affect the younger generation. It means that they're going to have to save more to have the same amount at retirement.
David's calling from San Francisco in California. Hi, David. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
How are you, Tom? I'm really getting pretty angry listening to this, especially the bad advice coming from your Nobel Prize winner. The idea that interest rates have been jacked and jacked and jacked since Jimmy Carter's days. I took financial management, and I was taught to never borrow over 5%. 5% was a dangerous number.
David, what do you mean by jacked? I mean, interest rates right now are at super historic lows.
There are historic lows for Dan Quayle, who's just been able to buy Safeway at a 0% loan. But for the average person that's paying 23% on a credit card, that's murder. 7% is murder. 10% is slaughter. 15% for student loans is slavery. This idea that the LIBOR has not been prosecuted, and ever since Jimmy Carter's days when nobody was enforcing the usury laws that said that 7% was illegal, and the idea that we've gone now for 40 years and we've outsourced all the jobs and we've stolen the land of the baby boomers and their parents' lands, the farms were gone. During Jimmy Carter, they lost them. During the savings and loans crooks, nobody got prosecuted. During the subprime, nobody got prosecuted.
Hey, David, let me pick up that gap between Robert Shiller. I'll bring it to you. You put money in a savings account, you make almost nothing in terms of interest. You borrow money for a student loan or on a credit card, as our caller says, and interest is pretty darn high. What about that spread?
Well, this is something that Elizabeth Warren wrote about years ago, and it's been a concern that interest on credit cards are very high, and sometimes they'll play tricks on you. You miss one payment, and then they raise your interest even higher, and then you're stuck because you have the debt. So Congress in 2010, as part of the Dodd-Frank Act, created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the objective of them is to look out for the consumer, take complaints, such as David's complaint. You can leave a complaint with them. Now, I don't know if they're moving fast enough to improve our credit laws, but that's what we have to do. We've done some of it, and I think regulation to protect consumers is a very important component of our national financial infrastructure.
Is there a structural response to that, Michael, beyond a complaint-by-complaint response?
Well, I think we've with the CARD Act, we've actually done a pretty good job of tamping down some of the abuses. From what I've seen, the research shows that especially the less sophisticated consumers have benefited a lot from restrictions on fees and interest rates that credit card companies can charge. So that's an example of legislation that seems to have worked pretty well. I'd also make the point that low interest rates, first of all, are not necessarily a Fed phenomenon. If you look at interest rates across the developed world, you see that for most government bonds, it's pretty much no – after inflation, you're getting no return on your investments. And it really doesn't matter what their fiscal policy is. So low interest rates are really a function of supply and demand. And they benefited a lot of younger people who've had to borrow. Interest rates on mortgages have been very low, as we all know, over the last 15 years. So borrowers are benefiting from lower interest rates as well. And you know, there's some questions about whether the spread should be as large as it is for some risky types of credit products.
Robert Shiller, we've just got a minute and a half here. Your CAPE ratio, your price-earnings ratio says watch out here. How close, if there's a cliff out there, what does history tell us about where it might be?
Well, I wish I could be more definite. So the CAPE ratio is up at 25 right now. But in 2000, it got up all the way to 46. That's, you know, close to twice as high as it is. And people get angry with me if I call this too soon. So I just don't know. It might get much higher. There's no clear way to predict. I don't know what the stock market is doing. And you have to take that nobody knows. So the thing is, don't put too much in it, but maybe you want some in it. So I'm just left with that. That's the best I can do.
Yeah, boy. People out there with whatever they managed to put together trying to figure out what to do with it. It's, as you say, there's nothing handed on a platter here. And watch out. Robert Shiller, it's always great to have you with us. We'll follow that ratio as she grows, see how far she goes. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller, professor of economics at Yale University, and Michael Finca at Texas Tech University, professor and director of the Center for Retirement Planning and Living there. Michael Finca, thank you very much for joining us today.
Enjoyed it, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, good luck to you. Get your antenna way out there and, cross your fingers, I guess. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.